think they're American royalty.
The wait is liberated. Iraq's army is defeated. Our military objectives are met.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil.
Maybe a third Bush White House would be a big mistake. Decide for yourself. This is the exclusive interview with Jeb Bush.
It's been a great trip. I love Salt Lake City. There truly is a Utah way about things.
Now, a special edition of The Doug Wright Show on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
We had, of course, fully intended to bring you this interview in our previous half hour, but because of the breaking news with The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announcing that in the United States and Canada, they would continue to go forward with the Boy Scouts of America, we wanted to get reaction to that, and we will continue to get reaction to that at 10:35. Rick Barnes, who, by the way, right now is up at Camp Tracy in Mill Creek Canyon, he will be joining us from the Great Salt Lake Council. We'll also be talking later in that half hour with Alan Endicott, who is the executive secretary with the Trapper Trails Council. So we will continue to follow that story as well. But we wanted to share this interview. It was really a lot of fun to talk with former Governor Jeb Bush, now candidate for the someone who wants to be the candidate for the presidency of the United States of America, shooting for the Republican nomination. He was in Salt Lake City. And I asked Governor Bush just kind of how things were coming down in Salt Lake City and his impressions.
Well, I just had a wonderful meeting with Senator Orrin Hatch, had a chance to visit with Governor Herbert and his lovely wife and the lieutenant governor, and John Huntsman, who's in town. So, we had a successful fundraiser, and so it's been a great trip. I love Salt Lake City. People here are, there truly is a Utah way about things, and it should be maybe exported out to Washington, D.C., where civility kind of has been lost for a while.
Governor Herbert is fond about talking about Utah ways and examples that we have here in the state of Utah. What kind of advice did you get and questions did you get from some of these individuals you had the fundraiser with?
Well, we talked about how to create an environment of higher growth, which is really what I am passionate about. I believe we can create an economy that will lift people out of poverty and give the middle class a pay raise for the first time in a long while. And so we talked about how to do that. We talked about concerns about regulation on the medical device business, which is a booming part of your economy here. We talked about how to simplify the tax code and shift power away from Washington. Governor Herbert's got a clear thinking way of viewing the role of state governments, how you shift power back to the states. He told me something interesting that I hadn't thought of, which is you take the cumulative budget of the 50 states, and it's $1.6, $1.7 trillion. That sounds a lot, you know, sounds like a lot of money, but it's $4 trillion in the federal government. And I don't think James Madison ever thought that we would have a form of government where the power resided in Washington. So using the 10th Amendment is another part of a strategy to create higher growth and to give people more freedom and less progressive, top-down driven decisions in their lives.
Governor, it wasn't that long ago that you came to Utah and shared some of your ideas that you implemented as governor of Florida, things that made a difference in that state. As you plan on ascending to the presidency, what is the plan for education from that national perspective? What would you intend to do?
That's a great question, because really the federal government's role in education is secondary to the states in terms of policy, and both of them are secondary to the localities in terms of implementation. And I don't think we should change that. I do believe that local decisions really are going to drive better student learning, and state reforms have to be more provocative. But the federal government doesn't have to play a role for the president to be engaged. The president can lead as the bully pulpit, and it's a national tragedy that we have about a third of our kids that are truly college or career ready. We can play like it's not true because we have a graduation rate of 80% in high school, but that's just not accurate, because that child that may have graduated from high school can't start taking college-level credits. They have to redo high school math and high school reading and English before they start taking college-level credits. And that has to change. We have to have much higher expectations, more school choice, real accountability. Then the federal government can be a partner with states that want to reform their systems to make them more student-centered. And that's what I would advocate as President of the United States.
The idea of No Child Left Behind, which has some family roots with you, Common Core has been a hot topic, school testing issues, they kind of rage here in Utah. How much involvement on any of the above should the federal government actually have?
Great question. I think the No Child Left Behind, in Florida we made our reforms prior to the passage of No Child Left Behind, so it didn't have as much impact for us, but for states that refused to have any accountability, No Child Left Behind forced them to have some accountability to know where students stood. And I think that minimum level of having a simple requirement that there be state accountability systems, not federal, but state, is important. The federal government should have no role in the creation of content, of standards, or curriculum. None, directly or indirectly. And if a reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind Act happens, I think the Congress will explicitly make that, you know, the law of the land. If they don't, I'll do it by executive order if I'm elected president.
We threw this open to our listeners earlier today, and I mentioned that I would have this opportunity this afternoon. We'll obviously play this on my show at a later date tomorrow. But Bob wrote in, and he said, talking about Social Security, he said, why raise the eligibility age to receive Social Security? Why not raise the income level, $250,000, for paying the Social Security contributions? How to save and how to help Social Security and ensure our seniors is a hot debate, too. What is your plan, Governor?
Well, we're going to lay out a plan this fall, and I think we may have to do a version of both as we and then provide some incentives for, you know, some relief for people that we need to protect and preserve Social Security as a supplemental retirement system for people that already have it. But it's not going to exist. When you get to the point where two people are providing support for one beneficiary of Social Security, it's unsustainable. It just doesn't work. And in 2030 or 2032, by law, there'll be a 20 to 25% reduction in benefits if we don't figure out a way to create a more sustainable plan. So I think it may require a little bit of both. As your listener probably knows, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan raised the retirement age. It's a month for every year, and the net result is that retirement age now is 67. It's 62 still for early retirement, and 67, soon to be 67 for full benefits. And we need to look at raising that over an extended period of time, not for people that already are receiving the benefit, but for those that want to have it going forward, because there's going to be a dramatic reduction in benefit costs. So raising the cap, as was described, and looking at raising the retirement age is on the table as we review this.
Running for the presidency, running for the Republican nomination, former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush. We will continue our discussion with the former governor. And, of course, there's a big elephant in the room right now. What about the Donald Trump factor? What about Iran? Much more is coming up here on today's Doug Wright Show at KSL News Radio.